This morning I want to share with you a passage of scripture that I started studying, and it's one of those scriptures where I'm like, I could come up with about 3 weeks worth of stuff out of it, and I have to take all that and confine it to 30 minutes today. But we're going to look at just the arrival of John the Baptist, and really as God worked through Zechariah and Elizabeth. But there is some powerful stuff that is in there. We're going to kind of concentrate on Zechariah for the most part, because he goes from having an ordinary day to an exciting day to an extraordinary day, all in the confines of one day. We all love those exciting days. An extraordinary day, that's the stuff of legend in our lives, and it's really what happened with Zechariah, and it's really what starts off Luke's letter to Theophilus, as Luke has taken time to unpack all the different stories, everything that's going on about the life and death of Jesus. And his friend Theophilus has lots of questions. What's going on? What's true? What's not? Theophilus grew up. My mom's going to get on to me. Theophilus grew up in a culture that had so many different religions all around them going on. And Theophilus has questions. He's like, well, we have the Roman stuff over here. We have the Greek stuff over here. We have all these different religions that are mixed in to everything because of all the empires that the Roman Empire has conquered and sucked in to things. So Theophilus has all these questions. And so Luke does this careful investigation. He actually goes and talks to people that were eyewitnesses of things, and he writes down the accounts of all of that. And the thing we have to keep in mind when we read the book of Luke, and really when we read the New Testament, it's a real document full of live witnesses saw this stuff. It's not just somebody sitting up, hey, I'm going to create a religion, let me write some stuff down. Luke goes and investigates what's going on. And so for Theophilus, he could have actually gone back and done some investigation and talked to these people that are eyewitnesses, or probably this time Zechariah and Elizabeth are long dead, unfortunately, but he could have talked to people and really reaffirmed that. And so it's really good when we realize that this is a living document that we can trust. And we can trust what the Bible says because it's full of accounts from eyewitnesses. It's really people that watched what was going on. And we can trust that. So Luke pulls this whole document together, sends it off to Theophilus. The first thing Theophilus is going to see when he opens that up after the little introduction is Luke just goes right into the life of Zechariah. Doesn't even go right into about Jesus yet. He goes into the person that's going to be the guy that's going to pave the way for Jesus, about John. But let's look at that. We're just going to unpack some stuff today in Luke right at the beginning. Starting at verse 5 in Luke chapter 1, says this: when Herod was king of Judah, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah. He was a member of the priestly order of Abijah, and his wife Elizabeth was also from the priestly line of Aaron. Zechariah and Elizabeth were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey all of the Lord's commandments and regulations. So here we have this introduction to two individuals, Zechariah and Elizabeth, and we have some details about their lives. Zechariah was a priest in the line of Aaron, so he was qualified to work inside of the temple as a priest. He could actually have the qualifications to go inside the Holy of Holies, this set-apart room, and then if he were to become the high priest, he could actually go once a year into the most holy place, which if he were here a month or so ago, we kind of looked at that and I pulled the curtain open, which happened with Jesus' death. But he actually had those qualifications, and then he also married the daughter of a priest, also in that line. So they were, like, legit in as far as that goes. And then some other details about them. At this time, just to kind of give you a picture of what was going on, at this time, he's able to work in the temple. There's probably at least 18,000 individuals that are qualified to work in the temple like he is. So he's part of this large order of people. And so because they have 18,000 men that are able to work the temple, they don't need 18,000 people to work the temple, so they have to break it up into orders. They had to break it up into groups. So they broke it up into 24 little divisions. And so then 2 weeks out of the year, it's kind of like the reserves, military reserves. So 2 weeks out of the year, they would work at the temple. And then all the big festivals that took place to finish out the 52 weeks in a year. So it was a pretty special thing when your order got called up for one of your 2 weeks out of the year. And then because there were so many guys out of that 18,000 divided into 24, you might not necessarily actually even get called to go work at the temple because they don't need all that personnel there. So Zechariah is a part of that. He gets to have that opportunity to work in the temple, most likely because they had all these individuals and because they were under Roman rule at the time. They didn't have the structure the Old Testament provides for the people were to provide for their priests. However, the Romans were like, we don't really care about your thing. We want to provide for our empire, so we're going to tax you to death. So most likely, Zechariah had to be bivocational. He probably ran a farm somewhere. But then the neat thing about him and his wife that they really bring out is that they were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey all that God commanded them. There's something really neat about their character. They were just hungry to know God and to be near him. They just desired to obey God. They were really the real deal. I would imagine that if you met them, you'd be like, wow, you really love God. You're not just going through the motions because of your family tree and how you were born and what you were born into. It's like, you really love God and you're really obeying him. And really, if we'd be honest, that's what our world around us needs right now, is to see people that are the real deal. That when they interact with us, they're like, wow, you really are sincere in your love for God. You really have seen Jesus. You really know him. And that's what the world around us needs. And I would think if you were to meet them, that's what you would think if you were to interact with Zechariah and Elizabeth. Wow, they are sincere and they are real. But then Luke, as he continues on in this document in verse 7, he continues, now here's the problem. They're loving God. They're walking with God. But then it goes on at verse 7. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to conceive and they were both very old. So now here you introduce the tension. First of all, because they're very old, in the way that Luke wrote that, it most likely meant they're in their 50s or 60s. So Elizabeth now at this point, she is past even the ability for her body to have a child. But yet because Luke brings that up in the document, you can tell this is a need that is heavy on their hearts. They're really broken over this. But here you have this big need that's going on in their lives. They're just broken. But yet, before that, it talks about how righteous they were. They obeyed God. They lived for God. Here's a big life lesson for us to consider. Do right even when life is not going the way you dreamed it would go. Elizabeth had a dream of holding a baby in her arms. She had that dream of having children running around. She had that dream, if we were to put it into our today's world, she had the dream of having a Christmas tree with a bunch of toys and gifts all around it and all the kids coming down on Christmas morning and ripping open the gifts and with such joy and excitement. She had that dream, and yet every year, if they had Christmas trees then, it would be like, I walk to the tree and it's just empty because I don't have what I dreamed of. But yet, her and Zechariah were like, we're going to live for it and walk with God even though our dream's not happening. Even though Zechariah and Elizabeth lived right, it did not mean that life was perfect. However, they continued to stay right with God, even though things had not gone in life as they dreamed. I mean, their character was, they were right with God, they were obedient, they were faithful. Their conflict, though, was they're old, they're childless, and it feels like them that their prayers are unheard and unanswered by God. For decades, they've cried out to God, God, we really want a child. And yet nothing happened. And here's the problem, though, because in their culture, in our culture, it's embarrassing because if you can't have a child, everybody walks up, well, why don't you have children? And you deal with all of that. And now we have science to try to help with all of that. But in their culture, it was devastating. It was socially devastating, and it was economically devastating. It was economically devastating because your children were your retirement plan. Because it's like, when I get old, my kids are taking care of me. And right now we have 3 children, so we're trying to decide which of the 3 we're going to live with when we're old. But in their culture, they had the same thing. It's like, Zechariah is most likely bivocational. He's probably running a small farm or some kind of small business to make ends meet, and he's doing it by himself. He doesn't have children to help him with the business, and he doesn't have somebody to rely upon when they get old because they didn't have the whole system of retirements and everything else like we have in our culture. So it's like they're devastated on that. But then they're socially devastated because in the Jewish culture, they knew that God opened and closed the womb. They knew that God was in control of that. You can read the whole Old Testament and see different stories of that. However, how people tend to always think the worst in a situation, and so when they looked at Elizabeth, they would kind of have that, oh, she must not be right with God, because she would have children if she was right with God. So there must be some kind of sin going on that she's like hiding. And so there's that social embarrassment of just being without child. So you get kind of the tension that's going on. But then I love the attitude that Elizabeth and Zechariah had, because their attitude was, even though God hasn't blessed us with what we desire, a child, and our hearts are broken, we're going to remain close to God. But then one day changed absolutely everything for them. And I love that. Verse 8 just starts with one day. Like back years ago, one day changed Leah Beth's life as we went out to dinner, and then I pulled a ring out and she saw the ring, and then she's like, oh, hey, we're going to get married now. And that was a really exciting day. One day changed absolutely everything. That day was totally different than any other day she had had up until that point. But so he starts off, one day. An ordinary day became an exceptional day that became an extraordinary day. It's an ordinary day for Zechariah. I'm going to go do my priestly duty just as I have many times before at the temple. Just like those that are in the National Guard or whatever, hey, they're calling me up. I have to go do my weekend training or my week-long getaway. He's like, I have my temple duty. They called me up. I'm going to the temple. It's an ordinary kind of thing. He's probably done it many times over the decades. Becomes an exceptional day. Because they're like, hey, we need to select who's going to actually be able to go into the temple building, into the Holy of Holies, and burn incense today. Who's going to get that opportunity this week? Because we have morning and night times that we're going to do the burning of the incense, and we got to pick people. So they randomly mix it up, and they're like, hey, Zechariah, you get to go in. So it's now an exceptional day. It's like, yeah, I don't have to go do all my work. Now I get to go into the actual temple building and do something. It's an exceptional day. Then it became an extraordinary day because while he's in there, he heard from God. So verse 8 goes, one day Zechariah was serving God in the temple, for his order was on duty that week. As was the custom of priests, he was chosen by lot to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and burn incense. While the incense was being burned, a great crowd stood outside praying. And I should have put an illustration up of what the temple area looked like, because there's all these walls and separations. Unfortunately for the women, they would have been in the court of women that was kind of outside. Then there was a wall, and in it a big gate that opened up. So at least if they were standing in that area, they could kind of look through the gate towards the big temple building. Then on the inside of the wall, there was a smaller area set up where all the men could go stand. Then in front of them was an area for the priests to stand. Then there were steps going up onto a kind of a landing area, and up there were some altars. One was this massive altar that was really gigantic where they would do all the animal sacrifices out there and all the different sacrifices from the Old Testament system. Then there was the building, and if I remember right, there was a couple more steps that went up to a big doorway that opened up, and inside of that was this big room called the Holy of Holies, or the Holy Place, right in there. And in there, there was right in the middle of the room, right before there was another curtain, was this altar for burning incense, and around the side some candles or something that were burning. And then behind this altar, which I talked about a month or so ago, there was another big curtain, and inside of that room behind it was the most holy place, which where the Ark of the Covenant would have been at one time, and it basically represented God's throne room, the place where God dwelt. So the incense altar was right there in front of the curtain. It was really the closest that a human could ever get to really the very presence of God, other than the high priest being able to go into the most holy place once a year. So it was a really big honor to be selected to be the one that went in to burn incense. So they would have started in the morning and the night, they burned incense. And the incense would burn, and this fragrant offering of this special mix of would create a cloud of smoke. It was a really sweet aroma that would go up, and it basically represented my devotion, their Israelites' devotion to God, and also their prayers rising up to God. So it was a very special moment. So everybody's outside praying. The women are kind of like tucked around because they realize it's about that moment. They're looking through the opening. The men are standing there praying. They're watching as Zechariah gets up. He walks over. He has a censer in his hand, and he gets into the big altar, and he grabs some hot coals. And then he begins to walk up, and then either has an assistant with him, or he takes another hand, and another hand he grabs the mix of incense that he's going to have. And so in each hand he walks up, and he comes up to the big doorway, and there might have been a little curtain there that kind of moves out of the way, and he steps into the holy place, into this dimly lit room. He's now alone. And he's taking a few steps, and he's walking towards the incense thing, and I can only imagine what's all going through his mind, because he's like, this is probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me to do this. So he's going through, okay, I got to think through all my training to make sure I'm doing this right. And I'm stepping up, and he's walking to it, and he's coming up, and he pours the hot coals into the altar. Then he takes the incense, pours it onto the hot coals, and it just starts burning, and the smoke just starts bubbling out and filling the room, and it's filling the room really nice, and says a prayer probably. And he's thinking, wow, I'm the closest I'll ever be. Probably sitting there going, man, I'd love to be right behind that curtain that's right here, be into the most holy place. I'm not going to be able to go there. The closest he'd ever be physically, in a sense, in the symbolism of everything, to the very presence of God. So the smoke's bubbling out. He's standing there. And I love this, verse 11. While Zechariah was in the sanctuary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the incense altar. Zechariah was shaken and overwhelmed with fear when he saw him. He's expecting to be in there alone. He's standing there, smoke bubbling out. He's watching that. He's probably looking ahead at the curtain in front of him, like saying a prayer like, God, this is what's heavy on my heart. This is the one opportunity I have to be here, or very rare opportunity. He's probably, every big prayer that he has in his life is probably like pouring out of his mouth really quick, because it's normally walk in, pour it on, turn around, walk out. It's what the crowd expected outside. Standing there, looks to the right, boom, an angel. I'm thinking at that point, I'm surprised he didn't just drop dead with a heart attack. Like, ugh! He's like scared. I would be scared. First of all, there's not supposed to be anybody in there. Second of all, it's an angelic being. God sends one of his messengers down there, standing there. And he's probably like, oh boy. Can you imagine all the things that shot through his mind really quickly in that moment? Did I miss something in my required preparations to enter this space? Did I do something wrong, and now God's mad? Did I not follow all the rituals to make me clean, ritualistically clean, to come in here? Did I mess up? Is there some improper sin or motive in me that the Lord is not happy with? Am I going to drop dead as has happened to other disrespectful priests in the past? Or am I going to be a leper for life like King Uzziah, who entered the temple? You can read about it in 2 Kings 26, who got so proud, he's like, I'm going to be a priest myself, walks into the temple, starts burning in the incense, and God immediately strikes him down with leprosy for the rest of his life, spent the rest of his life alone in confinement. And so Uzziah is sitting there going, did I mess up? Did I blow it? Am I in trouble? Because, hey, our natural tendency is to think the worst, isn't it? And so there he is. He's like, I'm a dead man. I'm in trouble. God just sent an angel to be here, and it's already an exceptional day that he gets to be in here. Now it's an extraordinary day because an angel shows up, and he's like totally out of himself going, what do I do? I am in trouble now. Why would God send an angel here? God hasn't even spoken in Israel with a prophetic voice since Malachi 400 years before, and now suddenly God's showing up to talk to us, and I'm here. I'm in a lot of trouble now. I am really in trouble. And then I like this in verse 13. It says, but the angel said, Zechariah, don't freak out. It's all right. Well, he really said, don't be afraid. And then I love this next part. God has heard your prayer. Could you think of anything more special to be pouring incense into the container of the smoke representing devotion and dependence upon God, the smoke representing this sense of our prayers going up to God? It's standing right there where that aroma and smoke can go into the room that represents God's presence, God's throne room. And then to have that, to then pray these deep prayers because it's a rare chance you get. And then to have God basically respond, I've heard you. 30 seconds before he thought, I'm going to drop dead. I'm dead. I'm toast. I'm gone. And now he's like, yes, God has heard my prayer. What an exciting thing. So don't quit praying. Even when the prayer continues for weeks, to months, to years, to decades, don't quit praying. Because the battle is won in prayer. Don't quit praying. And when God answers your prayers in a big way, it brings big joy. I can't, but I wish that it just showed there that, like, he broke down in a little dance right there, like, woohoo, God's heard my prayers. Because that's really how I would hope I would respond in that moment of, yes, God heard my prayers, and do a little dance right there. Because that would have been really appropriate just to stop right there and to worship God. However, the angel just keeps going. Don't be afraid, Zechariah. God has heard your prayer. Your wife Elizabeth will give you a son, and you are to name him John. You will have great joy and gladness. So clearly he prayed that. He must have just prayed that right there. Like, God, this is my one moment. God, we really are sad and broken that we don't have a child. And it's funny because he prayed a really big prayer because his wife is past childbearing age and he's still praying a big prayer of, God, we'd like a child. He is praying a pretty big prayer. And then God responds, hey, I've heard you. And then he goes on to describe John. He says, you will have great joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the eyes of the Lord. Do you get this? There's a dual prayer being answered right here. You have John or Zechariah and Elizabeth praying for a child. They're like, God, we want a son. God, we want a child. We want an heir. We want somebody to carry on the family name. God, we're tired of the brokenness and the pain. We have this big need because Elizabeth's probably past her prime and given up on her dream already. And the Jewish people feel hopeless too. They're like, God, we're under Roman rule. God, you sit there in the Old Testament, you talk about how you're going to send us a Messiah, you're going to send us a Savior, you're going to send somebody to rescue us, and you're going to do all this, and nothing's happened. In fact, for 400 years, you've just been silent. For Elizabeth, God, I've prayed this prayer so many times since I got married, probably in her late teens, early 20s, and she's like, for four decades, I've prayed this prayer. For 400 years, the Israelites have prayed this prayer. And God is silent on both sides. Z cries out to God to have a dreamed about child. The people are crying out to God for help too. And so when the angel sits there and goes to Zechariah, I've heard your prayers. He's also in a way communicating it to the entire world. I've heard your prayers too. And I'm going to do something. Living right and doing right does not guarantee all will go well in life or exempt you from problems, difficulties, or setbacks. Being right with God because we love him should be our motivation. We have a wrong motive if we strive to be right with God because we hope it will make life better for us. Because really it causes us to seek the gifts instead of the giver. And sometimes it's even possible that being right with God will cause you more problems than not being right with God. So it's better off that our motivation is, God, I just want to know you. God, I just want to be near you. God, I want to be close to you because you, God, are God. And not because, God, I hope that if I'm close to you, you'll do this for me. No, we got to get that out of our mentality of just be like, God, I want to be close to you because you are God. Because, I mean, hey, if you've had children, how much do you like it better when your kids just come up to you and they just want to be with you? Instead of those moments where you can tell they're just trying to be nice to me because they want something out of me. How much more special is it to God when we're just like, God, I just want to be near you because you are God. Long-term prayers and long-term godly living is always worth it. Elizabeth's prayed for decades and nothing has seemed to happen. Her prayers even outlived her possibility of her thinking the dream could ever happen. But don't give up on your big prayers, because your prayers might just outlive you. Don't give up on your big prayers. God can use your faithful life and faithfulness in the midst of difficulties to bless many. Zechariah and Elizabeth's past faithfulness showed that they were up to the task of raising the last prophetic voice in Israel's history. As these two raised John, they were investing in a future they would probably never personally experience. It was 30 years before Jesus was an adult. They probably didn't live that long to even see it happen. But God used them in such a powerful way. So then Zechariah is standing there. He's processing all this that's being said about his future son. He's getting that all in his head. And then he says to the angel, how can I be sure of all of this? I'm an old man, and my wife is well along in years also. I like the way the New Living Translation puts that, because he didn't say she's old too. I don't think their culture was much different then as it is now. You don't say your wife's age. But he's just like, my wife's old too, basically. And then the angel said, I am Gabriel. I stand in the very presence of God. It was he who sent me to bring you this good news. But now, since you don't believe what I said, you will be silent and unable to speak until the child is born. For my words will certainly be fulfilled at the proper time. I mean, he really picked the wrong time and place to doubt. Now, doubt is a natural response when God says something or God communicates something. A lot of times we do doubt. We see it in the Old Testament as you look at the different biblical heroes that we have. There were times that they doubted, and they didn't get in trouble. Zechariah is just like, God, how can you know this is impossible? Now, he should have processed everything that he had learned. And I mean, he's like somebody that should really know. He's a priest. Probably had the Old Testament memorized. And so it should have processed through his mind. Oh, Samson's mom couldn't have a child. God caused her to be pregnant, and she gave birth to the strongest man that never ever lived. Or Samuel's mom couldn't have a child, and there she's praying, and God gives her a child, and he becomes the last of the judges. Or Rachel couldn't have a child, and then God opened her up, and all her children became half of the fathers of the Israelite nation, the Jewish people, half the tribes. Or then, the greatest mom of all, Sarah, she was in the same place as Elizabeth. Here it is, she's past childbearing age. She's married to Abraham, who God promises to bless the whole world through in Genesis 12. And here it is, she's past childbearing. There, she's the exact same place as Elizabeth. Past childbearing age, unable to have a child, and in both times, God shows up to says, you're going to have a baby. So he should have known better now, because he could have just looked at it and go, oh, there's Sarah right there. And Abraham was held very in very high esteem, Abraham and Moses in their culture, so he should have right there. He picked the wrong place to doubt. And he's right there by the altar, closest to the presence of God that you could ever get in a symbolic way, and he's doubting God. It's rough. The great thing about God is when he says something, he does it. The great thing about God is even when I'm faithless, God remains faithful because he can't be different than who he is. Too often, though, we pray for a sign. We're like, God, I don't believe you. God, I don't trust you. And I have a feeling that in the back of Zechariah's mind, he's like, God, I just need a sign this is all going to happen. God, I just need a sign that this is really going to take place. Because I'm not sure if I walk out of here, because maybe it's just like the smoke in the room and it's making my head a little cloudy. God, this is like an impossible thing to know that you're going to meet this situation. God, I just need a sign. Hey, because really, if we're honest, doubt will often cause us to do some really goofy things, really stupid things. When we doubt, we at best, we try to do God's job for him. And at worst, we walk away from God and miss out on who he is and what he's doing. So it's like this crazy situation. He's kind of doubting, God, I just need a sign. I have a feeling that was part of it. So Gabriel's like, I'll give you a sign. He's like, you can't talk anymore. He's like, vocal cords just stopped working. I can only imagine what he's like. You know, the angel's like, you're not going to be able to talk anymore. You can't talk anymore. And he's probably like. He's probably like, I have questions. I need you. Hello, I need more details. If he goes to Elizabeth and he just starts, well, he can't even talk to her. She's going to be like, what happened? What is this? I need details. I want you to fill it in. I want to know what the room looked like. I want to know what they were thinking. I want to know what you were thinking. I want to. She's wanting details to fill everything in. I mean, hey, a lot of times wives want details from their husbands, and they never get enough. Can you imagine what it's like when he gets home and starts the most extraordinary thing ever happened, and he's got to go to his wife? It's like the worst game of charades ever. He's like, I can't communicate this to you. Imagine what it was like when he walks out of there. But the extraordinary is not really for me alone, and it wasn't for Zechariah also. Because verse 21, it goes like this. Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah to come out of the sanctuary, wondering why it was taking so long. He should have been in and out quick. And he's not coming. They're like, okay, did he drop dead in there? What is taking place? For those guys that were there every morning and every night watching the prayer times, they could probably set their clock on the routine. It's like this really formal guy walks up the stairs, really serious. He walks in the room. He's in there for 30 seconds, a minute or two, whatever it takes to do all that. Turn around, the door opens, some smoke billows out. They're like, that's cool. They pray. It's over. It's like minutes are going by. They're like, well, he didn't have watches. But they're like, what's going on? Why is it taking so long? They're like, did we see him go in there? Do we know for sure he went in there? Like doubting everything. They're wondering what's going on. The crowds are just curious. What is going on? Their imaginations had to be going crazy. Because here's the reality. When God does something extraordinary, it gets the attention of bystanders. A life is changed. A need is met. A healing and so far occurs. When God does the extraordinary, people notice. Zechariah could not hide that something significant happened. First of all, he couldn't hide it from the reality of the fact he was in there way longer than normal. Then when he steps out of that room, he can't talk. About 20-something years ago, I had met Leah Beth, and a group that she was with from her church came here and stayed and were sleeping on the floor for a weekend trip to Six Flags. And I was running the junior high ministry here, and I came up and was letting them in and out of the building all the time. And my heart really went out for that group. I was like, there's something about that group. I have to know more about this group of people, what's going on with them and everything. My heart just went out for that group of people in a really weird way. And I met Leah Beth during that time. It was really a special time for us. And I went down to Arkansas. I was staying with a mutual friend named Ty. He was like, hey, if you ever want to come down, come stay with us. And so I was down staying with him one weekend, and I just graduated from Edwardsville with an engineering degree, and nobody would talk to me whatsoever to even get hired for a job or anything. I sent out somewhere I found a file where I sent out like resumes like that thick. So I was down there just visiting. I'm like, hey, on a whim, because my heart's going out for this church, and I can't figure out why. On a whim, I'm just going to try to see if there's anybody that will hire me. So I just called. I randomly picked up the phone. I just started at the front of the alphabet in the phone book, and I'm just calling engineering firms and called this engineering firm called AMI. It's right at the beginning of the alphabet. And I'm talking, and this guy named Jimmy answered the phone, and I'm like, I'm just calling because I wanted to know the name of the owner of the firm so I could send a resume. So I was just like, hey, I'd like to know the name of the firm owner and so I can send him a resume. He goes, are you calling about the job? I'm like, yeah, I'm calling about the job. And he's like, well, let me get you information. So he's like, come on in, fill out an application, resume or whatever, application. So like that day I went, drove up to AMI, fill out an application. Later that day, Van, the owner of the engineering firm, calls me. He's like, hey, can you come back Friday for an interview? I'm like down in Arkansas just visiting friends and everything. I have nothing. So then somehow I scrounged together a suit. I don't remember if I drove home and got it or what I did. So I get a suit, I go, have the interview. I drive back home wondering what's going on. A few days later, he calls me and hires me to work at the engineering firm. I'm like, cool, get a job. So the day that I started at that engineering firm, I just remember driving up to the engineering firm. I'm driving up to it, and I'm like, God, my heart is going out for River of Life and that church there, and I can't figure out why my heart is so burdened for them. But I'm like, God, I'm starting my first full-time job. And I'm hundreds of miles from home. So I'm like kind of out here on my own. What do I do? And so I prayed a prayer and I'm just like, I just told God, I need so many days to get established in my job. I can't remember if it was 90 days or whatever it was. I can't remember the exact time frame it was. But the thing I specifically remember is on that day, whatever that day limit was, 90 days, I'm thinking what it was. That night, the pastor at the church calls and is like, hey, Mark, we'd like you to be our youth pastor. Like, okay, God, I'm kind of getting some things here. But so I went on, and I was their bivocational as their youth pastor, and I was doing that. And so at some point, a couple months later, we have this spiritual revival services going on. And so towards the end of the week, I mean, there's just some great breakthroughs happening. And there's this one guy there, I can't remember his name, but if you could imagine a guy that owns a rock company that sells landscaping rock. He owned a business on the side of the highway in Little Rock, and he sold rocks. So imagine kind of that rough, kind of gruff, kind of southern guy, owned a business. So during the revival services, he just gets blessed one night. And he's just like, God's so good, and he's just so great. And he had like this rough relationship with his wife. Everybody in the church knew about it, and because he was just kind of like rough country, kind of Arkansas, kind of works with his hands, kind of rough guy. So he just decides, I'm washing my wife's feet. So he runs and he goes into the kitchen, he grabs his big pot of water, and he's just like rushing up to his wife. And if you could picture the stage, it's like there's the platform, there's steps that kind of wrap all the way around it, and his wife is on this far left side. I'm praying on the steps on the very far right side with my shoulder up against the wall. And he walks up and he gets this big pot of water and he runs up to his wife and he's just like, real rough. He's like, turn around. And he's just like, turns her around and gets her. He's like, get a chair. And he's like, sit down. You know, he's just like doing all this stuff. Gets his wife to sit down. And I mean, she's like in a dress and pantyhose and everything. He's like gently taking off her shoes now. And he's washing her feet through the pantyhose in this pot of water. I'm like, oh, that's so touching. You know, everybody's watching. Tears are flowing. He's like bawling. His wife is just like bawling. It's like the super emotional moment and everything. Well, now he's like spiritually charged because there's been healing with his wife. So then he just decides, you know what, your feet aren't good enough. I'm washing everybody's feet along the stage. So then he goes to the next person, and he just pulls that person around, starts washing their feet, and he's like working his way all the way around the room. Mind you, at this point, I'm sitting there, all the thoughts going through my head of, that water's got to be disgusting by now. Even if that water's not disgusting, it's got to be really cold by now. So he's working himself around the room. And it's getting closer and closer to me, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm got my head down into the stairs, and I'm praying, and I'm like, oh man, he's getting closer. He's not stopping. I don't like this. I don't need my feet washed. I took a shower before church. And all these thoughts are going through my head, and then I'm like, okay, they're close enough now where it's going to look really weird if I get up to walk away from the altar area. So at that point, I'm like, maybe if I, like when you're a kid at school where you hide behind the person ahead of you and you're just like, if I don't move, the teacher, like, well, I'm invisible. Like, the teacher can't see movement. And I'm like, maybe he'll miss me because he realizes I'm intently praying. So I'm just like, I'm like, probably like there on the step, like, God, you're so good. God, you're so awesome. Like, really praying, God, please rescue me from this. God, this is going to be so embarrassing. That water's going to be so gross. And I hear the slushing of water next to me. And I'm like, I'm trapped. I'm toast. And then I feel his big, strong hands on my shoulder. And I'm like, I'm not getting away from this situation. Pulls me around. And I'm sitting there. And just as that's happening, the guy that was the evangelist comes up and pushes him out of the way. And he says, I have this. And he gets down and he gently takes off my shoes and he prayed an extremely prophetic prayer over my life in that moment. Like, I can picture the exact words that he said in the exact setting of everything that took place. I thought, that's cool. And then I got thinking about it and I'm like, just some of the stuff I'd been sitting at this altar praying about at that moment, he's now speaking out of his mouth as he prays over me. And so I'm like, this is such a great moment. He gets done. I was against the wall. The water was disgusting. I put my shoes and my socks back on. And him and the pastor, actually the two pastors, his two brothers that had started the church. So they come up and they just rush up on me. And Brother Tony and Brother Bob, the pastors there and the speaker, were just like, okay, we need to go have a talk about this because what was prayed was very, very, very significant. Let's go have dinner. So I believe Leah Beth went with me and we went out to eat with them and had dessert somewhere at Denny's or something after church because that's where you go after church. And so we're sitting there having dinner and we're unpacking all that. But the reality is when something extraordinary happens, it gets people's attention. When God does something big, people notice. And at that moment, Tony and Bob noticed something big just happened. It wasn't just an evangelist trying to get in on the action from a guy that was super emotional going around the room because really everybody else he prayed for, other than a few tears in that, nothing was really happening other than this guy was having a bunch of theatrics. But when he gets to me, it's like a significant moment. That it gets the attention of people when something big happens. So then getting right back to what's happening, we need to celebrate the ordinary and the extraordinary. When Zechariah's week of service in the temple was over, he returned home. Soon afterward, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and went into seclusion for 5 months. And then I love this part. How kind the Lord is, she exclaimed. He has taken away my disgrace of having no children. God met Elizabeth's personal need as he prepared something big for the future. Her response was proclamation and I bet worship. God is so good. See, we need to celebrate when a long-term prayer is answered. We need to celebrate when a long-term dream is fulfilled. We need to celebrate when a long-term hurt is healed. The fulfillment of your need today can also be for something even bigger in the future. Brag about what God has done. Give the blessing back to God so that others are blessed too. But here's the thing. Zechariah and Elizabeth had different responses to the news about what was coming. Zechariah doubted. Elizabeth celebrated. It's really the same people response that people have today. Some, when they hear about Jesus, their response is, I'm going to celebrate because I have met the King, my Savior. And others doubt. I don't think that's really true. I don't think that really happens. That's just the response that we deal with. But see, the reality is the impossible is possible with God. The difficulty you face today or have been experiencing for years could be a part of God's plan to reach people. Or it simply could be the consequences of poor choices or just the reality of living in a broken world. But the big thing is your prayers matter. The big prayers you pray today might outlive you. But the cool thing is, God hears your prayers. So just because you have given up on a dream doesn't mean God considers the dream to be dead. But even if the dream never happens, keep walking with the Lord. The best motive to have is to walk with God for who He is and not what He does. If you find yourself no longer dreaming, then get closer to God while allowing His Spirit greater access to your life, and I am confident that new dreams will grab your attention as your heart comes into alignment with God's heart. And keep in mind that God will use you no matter what your age.